And now, Westwood One presents the Lost Lennon Tapes, brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers. For all you do, this Bud's for you. Our host is John Lennon's longtime friend and confidant, Elliot Mintz.
Our celebration of John Lennon's life and music continues this week on the Lost Lennon Tapes. The original British invasion is at fever pitch in February 1964 as She Loves You knocks I Want to Hold Your Hand out of the number one spot, becoming the Beatles' second American chart topper in a row. And on February 7th, after one of the biggest advanced media campaigns in pop music history, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr arrive in New York for the first time. During the next 2 weeks, the Beatles will appear twice on The Ed Sullivan Show, perform their first American concert at the Coliseum in Washington, D.C., and play two shows at New York's prestigious Carnegie Hall. The scene at Kennedy Airport, February 7th, is pandemonium as tens of thousands of screaming fans welcome the Fab Four. Scores of New York's finest hustle the band, manager Brian Epstein, press officer Derek Taylor, and their entire entourage through the chaos and into the terminal. Inside, during a hastily prepared and barely less chaotic press conference, the American media get the first taste of the Beatles' cheeky wit, as one reporter asks the inevitable question, to what do you attribute your fantastic overnight success? Paul and George remark.
We can't tell you.
Wish we knew.
No idea.
Good press agent.
But as John Lennon remembers in his December 1970 working class hero interview with Rolling Stone's Jan Wenner, the Beatles had spent the previous 4 years preparing to invade the States.
We really were professional by the time we got here. We'd learned the whole game, you know. When we arrived here, we knew how to handle press. The British press are the toughest in the world. We could handle anything. We were all right. I know on the plane over, I was thinking, oh, we won't make it. Or I said it on a film somewhere, you know. We knew we would wipe them out if we could just get a grip on you.
I Want to Hold Your Hand, the first Beatles single to get a grip on fans in America, written and recorded during fall 1963. It was one of the last true Lennon-McCartney co-compositions.
Coming up on the Lost Lennon Tapes, Life Begins at 40. John Lennon live at the Dakota Country and Western Club, an unreleased demo from fall 1980. Stay with us.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back to the Lost Lennon Tapes. Here's our host, Elliot Mintz.
One of the most cherished memories I have of my friendship with John and Yoko is being with them when she, or they, as he put it, were pregnant in 1975, and then witnessing the profound change in John's spirit after Sean Taro Ono Lennon is born on October 9th. It's also John's 35th birthday and near the end of his long and bitter battle with the immigration authorities to stay in the United States. Sean's birth marks the beginning of John's new job as full-time father and house husband. Lennon remains the dedicated dad even after he returns to writing and recording nearly 5 years later with the Double Fantasy LP. Well, Sean's no longer a little kid. He's a bright, level-headed young man. And during my Christmas 87 visit to the Dakota, Sean and I sat down to talk on tape together. It's the first time we've done it, and the result is the first ever full-length interview for broadcast. This week on the Lost Lennon Tapes, it's my great pleasure to share some highlights from our conversation. Now, I've often heard the story that the first time Sean understood his dad had been a Beatle was when he was 3 or 4 years old while watching a video of Yellow Submarine at the Dakota with his best friend Max. But in all the time I've known Sean, I'd never taken the opportunity to ask him about it. So it's one of the first questions I ask when we sit down in his room. Is the Yellow Submarine story true?
Yeah, this is true. I just sort of put it together. What, you know, like, who are these strange people? I knew there was something called the Beatles. Mm-hmm. I knew that there was Yellow Submarine, and I knew that I always watched Yellow Submarine. And I just sort of pieced together that the people who sung their songs in the movie was called the Beatles, and my dad was the Beatles. And then I found out that my dad was the Beatles, and everything pieced together was sort of funny.
During the summer of 1980, after devoting nearly 5 years to caring for Sean and not about what's going on in the world of music, John and his son sail aboard the yacht Isis to Bermuda for a vacation. During their visit to the subtropical paradise, inspired by the music he hears on the radio and in local clubs like the 40 Thieves, John starts writing songs again. As Sean recalls,
he would do that in private.
He would.
He would usually write his songs in private or with Mom.
And then usually would sing them to Mom over the telephone, and she would sing her
song. Yeah, over the telephone. I remember that. And I would sing some, you know, just like Happy Birthday or something, or Mary Had a Little Lamb.
When 1980 came along, and it was time for Mom and Dad to go into the studio to record Double Fantasy, this was after the Bermuda experience, did it bug you at all? Because some child psychologist types and those types say that you had it great. You had a great opportunity because Dad spent all of his time with you. And then suddenly, it's 1980, you're 5 years old, and he went to work. He went back into the studio with Mom to make a record. Some would say, well, maybe Sean would have resented that psychologically, or it would have bugged him some way, where you felt that you weren't getting as much attention. Would any of that be true?
No. At that age, I was 5 years old. It was very near the time of his death. And I was smart enough to know that he had to do this. It was his job, mm-hmm. You know, and I knew that. And, you know, again, I related it with the Beatles, and I related it with music and stuff. And, you know, sometimes I'd go to the recording studios with them if it wasn't too late.
For John Lennon, 1980 is a year of rebirth, creatively speaking. It's also the year he turns 40, a milestone he reflects upon in Life Begins at 40, a song he starts writing at the Dakota using only his acoustic guitar, a drum machine, and that celebrated sense of humor.
We'd like to welcome you here to the Dakota Country Western Club. And in return for Miss Yoko Ono's wonderful gift of a very strange hair, I'd like this morning to sing you a little ditty that occurred to me in the throes of my sleep. It's called Life Begins at 40.
For the first time on the air anywhere, that's John Lennon live at the Dakota Country and Western Club, singing Life Begins at 40. It's a previously unreleased track from the Lennon Archives, and we'll be hearing more of my exclusive interview with Sean Ono Lennon as the Lost Lennon tapes unfold.
Coming up, more exclusive highlights from Rolling Stone's legendary working class hero interview you've never heard on national radio. Stay with us. Now back to the Lost Lennon tapes with our host, Elliot Mintz.
When John and Yoko sit down with Rolling Stone's Jan Wenner for the Working Class Hero interview in December 1970, the main purpose is to talk about the just-released John Lennon Plastic Ono Band album, Lennon's first solo studio project. Wenner asks if John's pleased with the LP.
Yes, this from the top. Of course I'm pleased with it, yeah. I think it's the best thing I've ever done.
In the lyrics for Mother, the album's lead-off cut, Lennon expresses his deepest feelings about his dead mother, missing father, and the son John left behind, Julian. But as his conversation with Wenner progresses, John feels compelled to be honest and direct about many subjects above and beyond his latest LP. The Beatles had split publicly and acrimoniously the previous spring, and by December 1970, John is ready to tell his side of the story. Lennon traces the beginning of the end to the death of Brian Epstein, the Fab's first manager, of an accidental drug overdose on August 27, 1967. On that day, the Beatles were studying meditation with the Maharishi for the first time.
Somebody came up to us and they said, "Brian's dead," and I was stunned, you know, and we all were, I suppose. And the Maharishi, we went into, "Well, what? You know, he's dead and all that." And he was sort of saying, "Oh, forget it, you know, be happy, you know, like parents, you know, smile." That's what Maharishi said. So, and we did, and we were along with the Maharishi trip, you know.
Wenner presses John to further describe his feelings when told of Epstein's death.
The feeling that anybody has when somebody close to them dies, there's a sort of little hysterical sort of hee-hee, I'm glad it's not me, or something in it. You know, that funny feeling when somebody dies, I don't know whether you've had it, I've had a lot of people die on me, you know. And the other feeling is, gee, you know, what can I do, you know? I mean, I knew that we were in trouble then. I didn't really have any misconceptions about our ability to do anything other than play music. And I was scared, you know. I thought we'd had it now.
When Wenner notes that Paul McCartney appeared to take over the Beatles' direction after Epstein's death, Lennon is reluctant at first to really get into it.
I don't know how much of this I want to put out, I tell you. I think Paul had an impression, he has it now like a parent, that we should be thankful for what he did, you know. But he kept, for keeping the Beatles going, but when you look upon it objectively, he kept it going for his own sake, you know. But not for my sake did he, Paul, struggle. But Paul made an attempt to carry on as if Brian hadn't died, you know, by saying, now, boys, we're going to make a record. You know, and being the kind of person I am, I thought, well, you know, we're going to make a record, all right. So I went along, we went and made a record.
The Beatles' next project was the McCartney-conceived Magical Mystery Tour, a TV special which earned the distinction of becoming the Fab Four's first flop when it aired in December 1967. But the film had its moments, notably Lennon's dream sequence with the fat lady and the spaghetti, and a soundtrack featuring I Am the Walrus, John's most ambitious studio effort up to that time.
And that was the B-side of Hello, Goodbye. Can you believe it?
John Lennon talking about I Am the Walrus, among many other things, with Rolling Stone magazine's Jan Wenner. And we'll definitely be hearing more of that wide-ranging interview in the months ahead on the Lost Lennon Tapes.
Coming up next, we'll join John and Yoko in Toronto for some live piece and hear an unreleased version of Power to the People. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Lost Lennon Tapes. Right now, let's rejoin our host, Elliot Mintz.
On February 2, 1969, Yoko Ono and Tony Cox are divorced, with Cox getting a reported settlement of 6,700 English pounds. This paves the way for John and Yoko's secret marriage in Gibraltar on March 20th and the beginning of a custody battle for Tony and Yoko's daughter, Kyoko. The next day, February 3rd, New Jersey-born businessman Alan Klein becomes the Beatles' business manager. Lennon had brought Klein into the picture, much to the dismay of Paul McCartney, who'd been trying to get John, George, and Ringo to sign a management deal with attorney Lee Eastman, father of Paul's wife Linda. Among Klein's first duties is to save the Beatles from their financially disastrous Apple enterprise. And on February 4th, 1970, after cutting all of their hair, John and Yoko trade their locks for a pair of blood-stained Muhammad Ali boxing trunks during a London ceremony with Black Power leader Michael X. The Lennons plan to auction the trunks and raise money for peace. Now, on the music for peace front, the Plastic Ono Band's live piece in Toronto 1969 LP peaks at number 10 on the Billboard charts in February 1970. After three experimental albums with Yoko, Two Virgins, The Wedding Album, and Life with the Lions, Live Peace is John's first gold album outside the Beatles.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Plastic Ono Band!
Okay, we're just going to do numbers that we know, you know, because we've never played together before. And well, it's a one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, get go, go. Step on my boots, Rachel. Well, you can do anything, be half of them boots, Rachel. You can knock me down, right on my face.
Live Peace in Toronto had been recorded to September 13, 1969, with John on lead vocals and rhythm guitar, Yoko on vocals, Eric Clapton on lead guitar, old Hamburg buddy Klaus Voormann on bass, and Alan White on drums. John told the BBC's Andy Peebles how the Live Peace gig and LP came together almost overnight.
We got this phone call from Toronto on a Friday night that there was a rock and roll revival show in Toronto with 100,000 audience or whatever it was, and that Chuck was going to be there and Jerry Lee was going to be there and all the great rockers who were still living, and Bo Diddley, and supposedly the Doors were top of the bill. We didn't have a band then. Mm. We didn't even have a group that had played with us for more than half a minute.
But I bet you didn't have too much trouble getting people to come and
called
play.
Eric. I couldn't find him. I don't know where the hell he was, but I finally got through to him. I got Klaus, and we got Alan White because we'd cut Instant Karma around that period, so I'd met him. He'd been on that. And I said, look, there's this thing on in Toronto. You want to come? They said, okay. Now, we didn't know what to play because we'd never played together before. And on the airplane, we're running through these oldies. So the rehearsal for that record, which turned into not a bad record, was on the plane with electric guitars. so you not even acoustic, you couldn't hear, saying, are we doing the Elvis version of Blue Suede Shoes or the Carl Perkins, you know, with the different break at the beginning, jing jing, instead of jet whatever.
In addition to the oldies, Lennon premieres a brand new song based on his own harrowing experience. Take it, Yoko.
We've never done this number before, so best of luck. It's called Cold Turkey.
Original live version of Cold Turkey from the Plastic Ono Band's Live Piece in Toronto LP. John Lennon records the studio version of Cold Turkey a couple of weeks after this September 1969 concert, and it peaks at number 30 in December. Now, following Cold Turkey in Toronto is the song on everyone's lips during summer and fall, 69.
This is what we came for, really.
Listen!
It's Give Peace a Chance, so... Sing along, will you?
Yeah,
I've forgotten all those bits in between, but I know the chorus, so.
Eins, zwei, drei, vier.
John Lennon and the Plastic Ono Band's in-concert version of Give Peace a Chance from September 1969's Live Peace in Toronto show, John's first concert since the Beatles quit touring in August 1966. Now, between fall of 1969 and February 1971, Lennon's political awareness evolves from Give Peace a Chance to Power to the People. The single version of Power to the People is produced by Phil Spector and released in mid-March 71. But while going through John's personal tapes in the Dakota vaults, we found a rough mix that sounds very different from the echo-heavy Spector single. John Lennon's personal collection that's an unreleased take of Power to the People from February 1971.
Next on the Lost Lennon Tapes, Cleanup Time, the Two Virgins cover art controversy, and a rare acoustic guitar version of John's most famous song. Stay with us. We're back with the Lost Lennon Tapes and our host, Elliot Mintz.
In February 1978, during John Lennon's house husband years, it's revealed that he and Yoko are buying additional apartments in the Dakota building as they become available. It's being done to give the Lennons more room to move, and it's a pretty shrewd investment. About the same time, John and Yoko spend more than $178,000 on plots of land in Delaware County, New York. They use the property as a vacation retreat, but the main purpose is to raise their own cows. One way to ensure John, Yoko, and Sean a constant supply of fresh dairy products. After years of self-abuse, it's cleanup time. Here's John at home, singing the demo for Cleanup Time, one of the tunes he later recorded for Double Fantasy.
Moonlight on the water, sunlight on my face. You and me together, we are in a place. Gods are in the heaven, angels treat us well. The oracle has spoken, cast the perfect spell. Now it begins. Let it begin.
this magic ship of perfect harmony. Now it begins. Let it begin. Clean up time, show those mothers how to do it. Clean up time, show those mothers. Time, show those mothers how to do it. There's really nothing to it, baby. All you gotta do is, baby, make it up. Travel, wherever we may roam, the center of the circle will always be our home. The gods are in the heavens, the angels treat us well. The oracle has spoken, we cast the magic spell. Now it begins.
A piano pounding John Lennon at home in the Dakota, working out the demo for Cleanup Time, one of the key songs from John and Yoko's Double Fantasy LP. Now, flashing back to February 1969, the duo's notorious Unfinished Music No. 1 Two Virgins LP finally hits the charts. It's the album of sounds John and Yoko recorded in May 1968 during their first night as lovers. But it took them months to get it released. It wasn't an album of songs, and its front and back covers featured graphically honest photos of John and Yoko in the nude. As the Lennons recall, John's regular labels, EMI and Capitol, wouldn't touch it.
So Joseph Lockwood, who I still like, he was a nice guy. But he sat down on a big table up at the top of EMI with John and Yoko and told me he'll do everything he can to help us put Two Virgins out, because we explained what it meant and why we were doing it. And he said that he understood it and he'd do everything he can to help us. And when we tried to put it out, he sent a personal note to everybody saying, don't print it, don't put it out. So we couldn't get the cover printed anywhere. It was really due out about 9 months before it came out.
And it didn't come out as Capitol Records. I think it came out as Tetra Gramophone or whatever.
Yeah, over here we had to go with some other firm. But now you can't get it for $200.
Needless to say, John and Yoko had a tough time with the media. With one notable exception, an upstart music and counterculture magazine called Rolling Stone. As founder Jan Wenner and Yoko recall, Stone's first real recognition came in November 1968 when it featured the Two Virgins photo in its first anniversary issue.
That was the first time we got any attention. I remember the San Francisco Chronicle wrote a story about Rolling Stone and it said, Nude Beetle Perils SF. And then with all the reaction, we sold that issue out, thanks to John and Yoko.
Well, I heard that people were queuing for at the newsstand.
We had to go back to press.
Yeah, amazing.
And reprint that. So John and Yoko brought us our first success there.
That was a big happening. And in a way, that album probably would not have been so successful. It wouldn't have circulated if it was just an album, because most people thought it was a bum album. I mean, what I mean is, well, we were showing our bums too, but I mean, I don't mean it that way. But, you know, and the thing is, because it got into the cover of Rolling Stone, somehow it made the statement that we wanted to make.
Well, it was when after it came out, I wrote a letter from the editor in the following issue about all the fracas and brouhaha and the sellout, and the motto and the final lesson and conclusion of putting them on the cover like that naked was, print a famous foreskin and the world will be a path to your door.
Well, you must have gotten a lot of flack as well for doing that one, and that was very courageous, I thought.
Speaking of courageous, Yoko's book, titled Grapefruit, is reprinted in February 1970. She'd given an early copy to John when they first met at her Indica Gallery show in November 1966. He was both intrigued and infuriated by its simplicity. One entry reads, quote, "Hide until everybody goes home. Hide until everybody forgets about you. Hide until everybody dies." In any case, Grapefruit helped open new areas of John's imagination.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for. And no religion, too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one. Imagine no possessions. Try. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will live as one.
Thank you.
From John Lennon's personal tape archives, that's a rare version of Imagine by John on acoustic guitar. The performance comes from the November 1971 Apollo Theater benefit for the widows of prisoners killed in New York's Attica State uprising. Almost a decade later, John discusses the inspiration for his best-known song with the BBC's Andy Peebles.
Actually, that should be credited as a Lennon Ono song. The lyric and the concept came from Yoko, but those days I was a bit more selfish, a bit more macho, and I sort of omitted to mention her contribution. Really? But it was right out of Grapefruit, her book. There's a whole pile of pieces about Imagine This and Imagine That. And give her credit now, long overdue.
We hope you've enjoyed this week's edition of The Lost Lennon Tapes. I seldom tire of listening to John. We'll be back next week to continue our celebration of John's life and music with more rare and unreleased interviews and songs from the Dakota Archives.
The Lost Lennon Tapes, brought to you by Budweiser, the king of beers. For all you do, this Bud's for you. The Lost Lennon Tapes, a weekly presentation of the Westwood One Radio Network in cooperation with the John Lennon Estate. Written and produced by Stephen Peoples. Production and engineering by Dave Kephart, with pre-production by Ray Klein. Research assistance by John Schwartz and Steve Longo. Special thanks to Jan Wenner. Our executive producer, Norm Pattiz. For Westwood One, I'm Roger Steffens. Thanks for listening.